Welcome to the Citizen Bitcoin Podcast. I'm Brady, and I'm sharing my journey learning Bitcoin, hoping it makes yours a bit easier. How's it going out there, all my Bitcoiners from all around the world? Thanks for joining me again for another day here at the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance. Today, we sit down with Jeff Booth, tech entrepreneur, board member, and author of the new book, The Price of Tomorrow. First, as always, we'll check in with Swan Bitcoin. You should get your auto stacking on with Swan if you're here in the United States. It's super simple. One, auto fund USD to your account. Two, auto stack BTC. Three, auto withdraw BTC. It's that simple. Set it and forget it. You can get going now. Use my referral link, swanbitcoin.com/Brady, to get $10 dropped into your account. That's swanbitcoin.com/Brady. You'll get those sweet bonus sats 30 days after your first Bitcoin purchase is executed. And speaking of our referral program, we want you to join SwanForce. You can sign up for SwanForce at swanbitcoin.com/enlist. You'll get a custom landing page. It's pretty rad with your avatar up at the top. So when your referrals come to Swan Bitcoin, they'll be greeted by your face and a quote from you that talks about why you love Bitcoin or why you recommend Swan. And of course, your referrals will get $10 in Bitcoin, and you will be earning 0.25%, a quarter point, for that referral for up to 3 years. All right, so you can be earning on your referrals for up to 3 years as you go along. This is just incoming revenue. So get out there, start shilling Bitcoin, start shilling Swan. This is an amazing referral program. All right, get on it. SwanBitcoin.com/enlist. All right, finally, you guys probably know that I've started a podcast for Swan called Swan Signal. We do Swan Signal live every week. We get a couple of Bitcoiners, we pair up some awesome Bitcoiners, create some great pairs for awesome, unique discussions. It's, I think, a very unique bit of content in the space. Really proud to be able to bring it to y'all through Swan. This week, we talked to Adam Back and Preston Pish, an awesome combo, 1-2 punch. You can check that out on YouTube, Twitter, Twitch, Facebook. We're broadcasting live there. Those videos will be archived there. But also, the audio always goes onto the podcast feed, which you'll find at swansignalpodcast.com. So add that into your Bitcoin rotation. I think it's a pretty unique podcast in the space, and I think you'll find a lot of value there. And of course, thanks as always to the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network. Subscribe to the feed, the Let's Talk Bitcoin Network feed. There's some other great Bitcoin-only podcasts on there, like Anita Posh's Bitcoin and Co., the former crypto economy podcast, now called Bitcoin Audible with Guy Swan, and Peter McCormick's What Bitcoin Did podcast is also on that feed. So lots of good Bitcoin-only content in one place. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we sit down with Jeff Booth. He's the author of the new book, The Price of Tomorrow. Jeff is a longtime tech entrepreneur. He led BuildDirect, a technology company that aimed to simplify the building industry, for nearly 2 decades. And he invests in and sits on the boards of many tech companies. So needless to say, Jeff has his finger on the pulse of the global tech industry. In this discussion, we dive into the ideas he's fleshed out in The Price of Tomorrow: deflationary technology in the time of inflationary monetary policy, the deep societal problems caused by inflationary money, how deflationary technology could combine with deflationary money, that is Bitcoin, to really shape a brighter future. So we soberly examine our current state of affairs, but we also consider a brighter future and the path to get there. Really, really enjoyed this one. Hope you all do as well. All right, Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time to join me today. Finished your book last night and really enjoyed it. Looking forward to this discussion.
Awesome. Thanks.
Absolutely. So, all right, we have grown up, or most of us have grown up at this point, with this kind of Keynesian fiat monetary policy since 1971, and even a little before that. I mean, it was kind of formalized in 1971. That we, you know, went off a gold standard. So this is just the way things are now. And I've kind of, you know, been calling this on my podcast and in some writing, default Keynesianism. You know, it's just, we don't know anything different. Don't really challenge it. This is just the way money is now. So the idea of like a deflationary asset-based money is, you know, very contrarian these days. So what kind of feedback are you seeing as being sort of a business leader, you know, advocating or espousing these ideas?
I would say it's struck a chord. It struck a chord with just about anybody who would read the book and has an open mind and is willing to explore first principles. For those people, I would say it's or people that are will be willing to explore first principles even if they hadn't read the book. But for those people, when they understand what's happening, they want to look deeper and it's more. Okay, how do we make the transition? And then there's people who will not question the validity of what I've said, not question the evidence of what I point to, but will say, well, what better choice do we have? And then let's just keep going on. And so it's interesting to watch what's happening as a result of the book, but that's actually why I wrote it, right? I wrote it because I was frustrated that nothing was happening. Like I could clearly see this, and nobody was talking about it and everything else. So, so it's done that. It's really, and I don't know for your listeners who haven't read the book, it's probably worth referencing what it is about and effectively. Mm-hmm. Effectively, technological progress creates efficiency, and that efficiency is deflationary in nature. Mm-hmm. And it's all around us, and it's moving into everything at blinding speed. Your phone is a really good example. Everything on it is free or almost free. And so technology creates abundance, and that abundance is hard to charge for. It it's cheaper and cheaper every year, and more better for you every year. And our monetary policy is the opposite. It's created inflation. So those two giant forces are competing against each other, and the competition is driving wealth into very few hands. Mm-hmm. And most people are not getting the benefits of technology are not getting broadly distributed because of the monetary policy trying to drive inflation against a deflationary deflationary trend that's bigger than anything that governments can do.
Yeah. It's so I mean, there's a lot there, and I think that answer will sort of guide us through the rest of this discussion. Let's dive in first to the idea of exponential growth, because I find it absolutely fascinating. And it's you know, the nature of exponential growth is that it gets faster and faster. It compounds over time. And it feels like now we're at this time where it's happening so fast that, you know, whereas before, you know, maybe throughout the last century, it was sort of happening in the scale of like a single human lifetime, then maybe like, you know, a couple of generational kind of change, right? But now we're seeing it every 5-10 years, things are extremely different. The way we live our lives is extremely different. The tools we have access to, extremely different. It's almost like, you know, if you look at the exponential curve, like an X squared graph, we're on sort of the elbow of the asymptote now. So, you know, what are we going to see in the next, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years? I mean, life is going to be drastically different, I think.
Well, I've done this on some other podcasts, and I've done this on stages all over the world. So so I'll do it here too, but I think it's really important to understand human beings are really bad at seeing exponential patterns. We're not designed to see. We never grew up with exponential patterns. We don't see them. Mm-hmm. And so a paper folding exercise is a really good example. So if I folded that paper, that's one fold, two folds, three folds, four folds. You can see how thick it is.
At four, it's getting folds. A little thicker.
Yeah. Yeah. And if I ask people how thick that is on 50 folds, most people answer at about 2 inches, right? Some people answer at 7 inches. I know it's, but if you don't know the answer, that's when I say most people, I'm saying 90% of people answer right there. And it's not because they're stupid. is because if 50% or 20% of people answered there and a lot of people got the answer, then it's because human beings are always tricked by exponentials. We can't fathom how fast it's moving. So in 50 folds, that piece of paper would reach the sun. If you could fold it 50 times, you can only fold it 7.
Yeah.
But it would reach the sun. And that has enormous...
That was definitely jaw-dropping to me when I read that in your book. I was just like, that's... Yeah, be right.
And then what do you do? You go Google it to check if it's right and everything
exactly.
else. And because it's so far out of touch of what we believe is possible, that it's just so hard to comprehend. And we have technology moving at that rate. And by the way, that's exactly why we underestimate technology's impact in the beginning. Because in the beginning folds, it only looks like this.
Right.
And so you'll see a new technology, and 3D printers is probably a good example of a new technology that is people have locked in their brains of what 3D printers were 5 years ago.
Yeah.
And you print a little, it takes a day to print a little plastic piece and thing, and people dismiss it as irrelevant versus the hype and the promise. And it goes through a hype cycle. Mm-hmm. On the other side of that hype cycle, it keeps on doubling. And so what if people saw where that technology was today, it would blow their minds, and where it will be tomorrow, it'll blow their minds. So that is the base layer today. That technology doubling is the base layer of everything else. So that digital nature is moving into every industry. So you would expect the same power that you have in your phone versus you had 20 years in your phone. You'd expect that to get that everywhere, that abundance, and what will change everywhere. We will, but our monetary policy is not designed for it.
So you think then, like, I guess getting back to the question, I mean, that's a great basis for this question. And I appreciate you laying that out. I guess in terms of Moore's Law, we're what, 30, 40 folds in, I guess, from back in the 50s?
33 folds. And if you just for reference, that would take 33 folds would be from Boston to Detroit, right?
Okay.
34 folds doubles that. And,
right.
and so we're now in the thick steps to the sun, right?
Right.
And so, but all the technology you're using today and all the things that are in your phone today, you're looking backwards at the last doubles.
Yep.
And so when we see self-driving cars come out and everything else, or just recently, Elon said that they're going to go two-way charging onto the grid and everything else from the electric car, so you could charge both ways in peak power. The things that are coming forward are so mind-boggling. It's just hard to comprehend. And so that's why I use that example in the book, because if you understand that example and you can start to think like that, you can get in front of some of the trends that are happening, and you can bet on where things are going easier.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the change then that we can expect over the next 5, 10, 15 years is because we're changing so quickly now, so fast, like you said, the steps are massive that we're taking. We're in store for just more and more mind-blowing decades and years to come. Like
it's moving so fast. It's hard to comprehend how fast things are moving.
So do you think we've reached like escape velocity on the scale of a human lifetime? Like, I mean, you know, what will we see as 40, 50 year olds?
Yeah. So that's interesting. You actually bring up a point. I forget who I brought him to one of my conferences, but at one of the longevity experts who talks about specifically that you actually don't have to escape velocity in human lifetime. You only have to add years every year. Right. It's actually not very far away from, no, I don't want to be 90 years old, live forever.
Right.
So I hope they do it faster, but, but there's a whole bunch of things coming that we haven't been prepared for or even prepared to even question. And those things that change our belief systems and everything else are really hard to accept, even if they're true.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, our brains, just like they're not equipped to handle, you know, or understand exponents. We're evolutionarily not equipped to change this fast, right?
That's right.
I mean, yeah. So, you know, it's already, this conversation's already kind of blown my mind. Let's talk a bit about Bitcoin while we're talking about this. You know, like you said, the kind of digital exponential growth is sort of the base layer for everything, all the technology that we're seeing happen now, the amazing stuff, the supercomputer in the palm of our hands, you know, all of the tools, the thousands of tools that have been consolidated down into this little device. Bitcoin is built on top of that. It's built on top of the internet, which also, you know,
network effect and everything else.
Network effect. Money's a network effect itself. Yeah. So how fast, I mean, if Bitcoin is going to be, let's just assume that it will succeed in becoming the new like global standard of money, how fast could it possibly happen?
So I think what's happening right now, it's actually getting more and more trusted all the time. And the on-ramps and all that's happening is, it used to be a little pet project for cryptographers. Some people got into it. And actually, same forecast all the way through on how do we create trust in money, right? That's where it started, that can't be manipulated. And so how fast that can happen, well, there's a whole bunch of other events that need to happen to be able to speed that up. But if you think about some of the events that are unfolding in real time right now, yeah. U.S. with 80% of world trade denominated in U.S. currency means there's a whole bunch of countries right now that, why the U.S. currency is getting stronger is there's a whole bunch of other countries failing because, and their businesses are failing, and they're trying to get U.S. currency to pay things. And so that supply demand equation. So even though the U.S. is printing like crazy, the dollar is still getting stronger, right? It doesn't, but it's because the world trade is denominated in U.S. dollars, and these countries, that pain is in countries because as the U.S. dollar gets stronger, that debt explodes in real terms, right? It gets more expensive to pay back. So there's a race for U.S. currency right now. But you can imagine on the other side of this, there's a whole bunch of currencies and a whole bunch of countries that are going to fail, right?
Right.
And if you look backwards, Venezuela, what's happening right now, or sort of in the last couple of years, if you had Bitcoin in that, in Venezuela, you could save your family, you could feed your family and everything else. I suspect at 5 million, 10 million% inflation rate in Venezuela, that nobody is going to give up their Bitcoin, right? And sure. And again, when we create a new currency, still people won't give up their Bitcoin. So you develop an on-ramp of people that trust that more, right? Than another currency. That's happening in Lebanon right now. It's happening all over the world. And so those on-ramps are making Bitcoin stronger and stronger. I can't predict exactly what time that happens. There's obviously a scarcity rule in it. But I do believe that ultimately governments are going to be forced to peg to Bitcoin.
Yeah. And I mean, the network effects of the dollar obviously are really strong too. So, you know, Bitcoin has to overcome those as well. But yeah, I think once dominoes start falling in terms of sovereign currencies shifting to Bitcoin, begging to Bitcoin, then it's just kind of a race at that point. And you're looking at like S curve of adoption, you're sort of on that asymptote at that point.
Yeah, and I think we're still early in that, really early in that. But when you see Paul Tudor Jones come in, and so it's just moving up, right? And now other hedge funds are going to be forced to do that to just create the same beta. And so they're not going to want to be left out. So you're going to have a whole bunch more people in conversations like this that are bringing more people onto it. And the currency is portable anyway.
So I have this conversation with family and friends about deflation and inflation, what money really is, what I've learned about, you know, from Bitcoin. They often ask me like, okay, I understand why, you know, the cost of technical goods, technology is going down because it gets better over the years and faster. But, you know, look at non-tech sectors like education, real estate, healthcare, we've seen massive inflation there. You know, why is that? Why is one deflationary and the other not?
Do you provide them with a sufficient answer or?
I say just because, you know, they're human based and humans don't scale, you know?
So that's not the reason.
Okay. This is why I asked you.
The reason is, so everybody says real estate always goes up. In to try to stop deflation, central banks have pulled forward demand. We've created $185 trillion of new debt in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. $185 trillion to produce $46 trillion of GDP growth. Right. So $4 of debt for every $1 of growth.
Okay.
That's before COVID. Going forward, and as you know from the book, if it's exponentially deflationary, it has to be exponentially more debt to start mm-hmm. to try to stop that. Right? Right. That's what's happening. So
I want to pause you right there, real quick. So how have we created so much money when, you know, like we look at numbers like from the Federal Reserve, they've printed $6 trillion for this COVID crisis. What are the other ways that money is printed in this way so that, you know, it's sort of hidden? We hear numbers from the Federal Reserve. That's not the total though.
Yeah. So what I'd say is, let's start with what I was saying, because debt itself isn't bad, right? So when we say printed, debt itself, if the debt could be paid back, then debt itself isn't bad. But if the debt could be paid back, then it has to slow growth in the future, because taxes must go up. Essentially, you're pulling forward demand. It's really easy. These systems aren't as hard as people would have you think they are, right? Mm-hmm. Think about it in a single person system, you and I. If you borrow $1 million and nobody knows you borrowed $1 million, your internal economy, you could hire gardeners, build a new house, everything else. You look really rich. And everybody's looking, wow, how does he have all that money? And then if 2 years later you need to borrow $2 million to pay back the interest on that, and you can get away with it, you still look rich, right?
Right.
And I'm trying to save my money and spend thriftily and everything else so I can buy things without debt. You look really rich. At some point, you have to pay that back. Right. And it reverses. That's just how an economy looks, right? If you just blow that up overall. So if people pull forward demand, governments, individuals, corporations pull forward demand, and you can live way beyond your means. And then in the future, you have to pay that back. Now, so assuming you could pay back the $185 trillion, right? Or now it's $250 trillion for $80 trillion global economy. Assuming that that could be paid back, then growth must slow in the future because you have to increase taxes to pay for the debt. Mm-hmm. But inherently, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Growth, you can, if you spend debt to make a business better, you can mm-hmm. you can grow faster. It's not inherently a bad thing. But when you can't pay it back, and you change the rules to pretend you can pay it back, right? Or that's when it becomes, you warp capitalism, right? So that's what's happening today. And so piling on, you're not getting rid of any debt. You're piling on more debt to solve a debt problem in the first place. And you're creating asset bubbles everywhere. Mm-hmm. That applies straight to the other thing that we're talking about, to housing or to any of the asset prices or education and everything else. Let's look at China as an example on housing. If everyone in China knows that they're going to devalue the currency, and by the way, they have to devalue again to protect mm-hmm. jobs, so the currency is going to go down. Everyone in China says, I got to get my money out of China, and I got to put it into an asset. And that asset is U.S. real estate or Canadian real estate and everything else. And so there's massive money chasing, mass free money, essentially, chasing assets that are stores of value, and that's what's pushing up those. That's what's pushing up those prices. If you didn't have student loans that could never be paid back for mm-hmm. for education, you wouldn't have the education cost where it is. So the question, you have to look at inverse of the question. If you didn't have $185 trillion of debt creation in the last 20 years, what would real estate look like in prices?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you would see the trend's been there all the way along everywhere. It's in everything. Mm-hmm. You would actually have prices lower everywhere.
Right.
And then the next question is, can you keep doing that and for how long?
Right.
Right.
So I mean, basically, we've removed the store of value component from the money. So store of value then is like sought in other places. So you take this like cheap money, that's free money basically, and like, I'm going to put it in something that actually has value because it's scarce compared to the money. And then you build up this monetary premium, which makes sense. But the flip side is that technology actually is advanced, or like is, you know, doubling in exponentially so quickly that it, you know, it deflates in spite of all that inflation, right?
But you've set up an incentive structure that's warped, right? So let's say I'm a business owner. I'm a CEO of an airline, right? Okay. And I have two choices: put my money in cash, or so take those and save cash for a rainy day. When the government is saying, "I am going to penalize you, CEO, for doing that," mm-hmm. if you do that, I'm trying to make your money worth less money, right? So cash is getting killed. Is the CEO going to save cash in a free market where all the other CEOs are kind of doing stock buybacks because it's the best choice for their money?
Right.
So then when the system is anything little fails, oh, we need bailouts. And so when you start to warp capitalism by granting these bailouts, because then you're really in the later innings of debt crises.
Yeah.
Currency crises.
Right. So I like this framing that you put, that where, you know, you pull the demand forward, and that, you know, if you can't pay it back, right, then you're literally just, it occurs to me that you're literally just stealing from the future productivity of people, right? So not just, you know, our future, but obviously like generations down the line. And we've seen that, like, you know, if you look at a graph of productivity and mean wages about in 1971, mm-hmm. and this is the first graph at the top of a great website, just a compilation of graphs called WTF happened in 1971. You know, median wages kind of flatline and the productivity continues at the same trajectory. Yeah. So it's almost like time theft or productivity theft.
So when you say time theft, and Keynes, so a lot of times things go on, there's Keynesian and everything else and they're bad word. He was actually a really smart economist.
Yeah. Right.
What he predicted in 1930 he wrote a paper called The Economic Possibilities of Our Grandchildren.
Yep.
And he predicted a 15-hour work week.
Yeah.
And it was tracking along that till 1971. At that time, I think there was a 38-hour work week. Most families, one person worked, not two.
Right.
And we were tracking along that as that those productivity gains were built to society. Going off the gold reserve changed that trajectory.
Yeah.
Slowly at first, right, and then faster and faster as would be predicted.
Yeah. Yeah, and Keynes, you know, I've said this before too, that Keynes kind of gets a bad rap now, and we sort of, you know, labeled this, you know, this fiat monetary policy that we're in now, this inflationary monetary policy, with his name. But he also, you know, prescribed a countercycle measures, right? He was like, all right, we can do this to help sort of, you know, stem the effects of capitalist cycles, the down effects of capitalist cycles, but then you've got to raise taxes and raise interest rates afterwards. But it's that countercycle measure that just never happens, right?
And that's so he actually advocated in Bretton Woods for something called the Bancor, and not something pegged to the U.S. dollar, mm-hmm. so that this wouldn't happen.
Okay.
Right. And effectively, U.S. was a power at that time, and they advocated for gold in the U.S. dollar, and that's what happened. But that's a bit. But when a country can unilaterally make a decision, mm-hmm. and export the problem everywhere else,
yeah,
they'll make that decision.
Yeah, every time it's irresistible.
It's irresistible in a crisis.
Yeah. So what is Bancor? I mean, I've seen this. It's an acronym, right? BANCOR.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an acronym. It's just it was a way to peg. It would have been an old version of like Bitcoin, right? So the, a way to, for governments to agree on a principle that you couldn't change, you couldn't change the underlying currency,
which would be gold in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're sort of forced at this point. I mean, this inevitable end of these inflationary monetary policies, you know, Austrian economists, people who have advocated, you know, going back onto a gold standard for 50 years now, have been saying, all right, it's been called the crack up boom, for instance. But, you know, every time that one of these cycles happens, it's like, is this the last one? Is this the one, right? And it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And of course, we're all asking the same question now, is this the one? You know, we can't know for sure. We'll see how it all plays out. But this is the first big one where we've had a decentralized, open source alternative that can't be very, you know, can't be easily co-opted by central banks or governments as an alternative. So, you know, what do you think that just the mere existence of Bitcoin will change the could have an effect and change the outcome of this current crisis?
It's hard to say on this one. Can governments get away with it one more time? Or right. I don't know, but let's just go back to first principles and say, where is your money right now, and what are you doing with your money, and what is that, and ladder that up around the world. So right now, government, we know you have to know that interest rates are going to go negative all over the world, right? Just if you looked at math, they have to try to drive growth, and they're going to have to go more and more negative. That mm-hmm. breaks a whole bunch of things that we believe in already. Like, how do you price insurance with negative interest? Like, there's so many things that just break. I go to the bank, I put my money there, and then I get less money out. It's gonna make people crazy.
Right, mortgages.
Exactly. Like, there's just so many things as this starts to happen to try to drive growth. But let's say they get away with it. Effectively, you're doing the same thing at scale that we were talking about before. So I'm a CEO of a company and everything else. Do I keep cash? So what are you going to do? You're going to get a mortgage, right? Do you keep cash? You're making the system more and more vulnerable in the chase of smaller and smaller growth. Remember, before $4 to $1 GDP, now way less than that, way more dollars of debt to GDP. Yep. And now we're saying, wait, we can solve that problem. Let's make it worse. Right. Yep. So you're creating instability everywhere. At some point, so now let's say you're actually penalizing cash holders. And if you hold cash in that environment and they get away with it, you're going to get killed. Your cash is getting destroyed.
Yep.
And so you're going to go and buy these assets and everything else, and you're making the system. And so a whole bunch of people are setting themselves up for a giant fail.
Yeah. Right?
On the opposite side of that, if deflation happens as it should, right, and they don't get away with it, and you hold assets and a whole bunch of debt, you're going to get killed.
Yeah.
Right? So that coin flip, for you and everybody else and me and the world and governments and everything else, that coin flip, whether they get away with it, is binary in nature on both sides of that.
Yeah.
Right. So, and Bitcoin protects against that, right? So Bitcoin is a hedge against that. And that's why it's getting more and more on-ramps of money going into it. I actually can't think of if you want to make a ton of wealth, you concentrate everything. Right. If you want to protect wealth, you diversify. So if you want to make a bet on what other governments are going to get away with and currencies and what happens here, you could make a bet and go all in on real estate and everything else, knowing full well that at some point they're going to have to tax that totally different. Right. Yeah. And you can't move it.
Yeah.
Right. Or you could make a bet, I'm going to stay in cash and watch the deflation happen, and then I'm going to buy assets for pennies on the dollar. You could make those bets.
Yeah.
But both of those bets are binary in nature. And again, on the Bitcoin, there might not be an asset class better than Bitcoin right now because it protects against that happening. Now, it could go down. Maybe governments get together and say, okay, we're going to create something that looks like Bitcoin. We're going to do it ourselves. Yep. I see that is a low probability event in this market, in this cycle.
Yeah. So Bitcoin, like, if we, in a sound money world, like some would argue that since the government couldn't print money, at least not nearly as easily, you obviously could borrow money, but you couldn't print more of it if we have a Bitcoin standard. It is the most, the hardest money that has, you know, possible basically. And by 2140, it'll be, you know, have an infinite stock to flow ratio. So if we can't print money, like how do we respond to a crisis like this when there's suddenly 25% unemployment, lots of small businesses at risk, if we can't like print a bunch of money and just hand it out to people to like survive the crisis?
So this is a really interesting, because I think this is where we've been so fooled into believing this is the only way because we've lived in it so long, they can't see the other side. Yeah, if you couldn't, savings would go up in value. You would incent savings. So if the world looked different and you didn't have negative interest rates and there weren't incentives to be able to purchase and everything else, if you that incentive created more and more debt and more instability in the system, then the other way would incent savings. And there would be lots of room for events that happened in the market because their savings would be there, right? And the other side of this is, healthy systems are yin and yang, right? Yin and yang. There's day and there's night, right? There's young and there's old. There's birth, there's death. Capitalism doesn't work if there's no failure.
Right.
You have to have, if you say, so government's saying, oh, we're going to protect and never have failure, it doesn't work, right? Yeah. It's impossible.
I mean, isn't that essentially socialism at that point? Like, I mean, what we have now is socialism for the rich, for the big corporations.
That's what's happening, and it's easy to get away with too, because it doesn't look like that to governments. A corporation with tens of thousands of employees says, if you don't save this, I have to fire all these people, mm-hmm. and they can easily say, I'm protecting all these people.
Yeah,
but that's actually not what it's looking like. So let's go into, again, a little deeper. 3 weeks ago, Federal Reserve took $2.3 trillion of junk debt off the balance sheet and everything else. And that, in real estate, commercial real estate, looks like effectively subprime happening in 2008. That's why the reason they did it, because if it started to unwind, it touches everything.
Yep.
But the byproduct of that is, let's say commercial real estate doesn't fall, right? Because you new fresh capital, here you go. Forget the bad stuff. We'll take that on our balance sheet. And when that real estate price goes, so we're going to protect it from falling. And then it's going to go up because we're creating all this capital. And then because we protected it from falling and we took taxpayer money and did that, we also have to go and pay for all the people left out of that price rise, that rents go up in price. Mm-hmm. And those people can't afford to live, right? So how do we create social safety nets for them? Well, we have to pay those people more,
right?
To pay for the same assets that we created at the high price in the first place.
Yeah,
right. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's absolutely insane. I mean, we are gonna look back at this, in the future as just an absolute insane time. I mean,
historians will not be kind to current central bankers and to current policy. When you see every bag of tricks coming out to oh no, it's this. Oh no, it's this. We can get it. And by the way, you largely get away with it because you push the asset price higher, right? And then later on, you say, oh no, I can pay back the debt because the asset price is higher. But then you have to pay more people to work harder and harder, more and more hours to pay for the higher asset prices that you're creating in the first place.
Sanity. Time theft. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about, you know, a bit more like a hopeful future, right? I mean, obviously what we're in now and what we're going through is, it's a terrible time. It's a scary time. It's even more terrible and scary for people who are not, you know, privileged enough to be close to the source of the printing of the, you know, the world reserve currency. Unfortunately, I can imagine that a lot of people in other countries are, you know, if they're not already, will be very upset with the United States and the way that they've been treated if that kind of comes to light and understanding spreads. How can we transition, right? You said earlier that your peers in the kind of corporate world are asking, like, okay, this is what you're saying makes sense. What's the way out? Like, how do we transition? Is there, let's hear like a sort of a, you know, optimistic scenario versus the pessimistic scenario.
Sure. I'm an optimist. I probably wouldn't have written the book if I wasn't an optimist. But I'm an optimist and I'm also a realist. Yeah. I'm an entrepreneur, and in a bunch of the different companies, you create value by first kind of looking deeper and seeing things that other people don't see, and then trying to create a better future to that. To do that first job, what people don't see, you actually have to explore things that you, questions that you might not ask. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's what drove me to write the book. So you went, so what we've talked about so far are fact-based, evidence-based, and you can see it everywhere. This is a fact. There's two forces, monetary easing, technology deflation, competing against each other. And technological deflation is going to win in the end, no matter what.
Yeah.
The path to get there could be wars, on the current path will be wars, revolutions. Mm-hmm. I hate to say that, but it will be. Because when you steal a whole bunch of wealth from some people and give it to certain people, it's easy for politicians to get elected and say, it's not your fault. It's those people over there. Right.
Yeah, sure.
And the assets get taken back. Right. So, and typically, or it's easy to blame another country and say, they're stealing your jobs. It's not our fault, right? China right now. Right. Mm-hmm. And all of those things are missing the root cause of the problem. And most people will be blind to the root cause of the problem. They will believe the narrative. Right. Okay. And once they believe the narrative that's happening, that it's hard to unring that bell. Right? Yep. It's hard to change somebody's mind. So yep. That's why I wrote the book. So people could understand the first principles and what narratives they're likely going to hear. Next step, next step, next step.
Mm-hmm.
So if technological deflation is a good thing, I can't understand why the value of your money going up and us getting more and more every year for less mm-hmm. is a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Let that ring for you. Right? it's not a bad thing. Right? So, but it changes the current environment, and it changes what's valued and asset prices and the debt. And if you have deflation against too much debt, the debt can't be paid back.
Right.
So that transition is going to be hard because governments probably won't allow that to happen. Right. So now we're going to assign a probabilities of distribution to what ends up happening to get there. But it's not impossible. Right. Governments could say right now, okay, this is what's happening. It's happening all over the world. And this is what it said. How do we build to that? And they could come together and say, agree on a common currency. And they could say, okay, we're going to have to somehow reset this debt, pay this back or whatever. And that's what it's going to have to look like. And maybe current stores of value like real estate, taxes must go up a lot on that to be able to make them less stores of value as you transition to a digital economy. Right. Yeah. And digital economy everywhere. And I often ask the question here, instead of asking, how do we grow our way out of this? Because that's what every government is doing. And we'll manipulate currency. We'll do whatever it takes to grow our way out of this.
Mm-hmm.
I often ask the question, what would it look like if we weren't building for growth? Like, what if we looked at the world and said, if technology is going to do more for, and give us more for less all the time, and we don't have to pay for it, why are we trying to pay for it?
Right.
Why are we trying to create more jobs in a world where there's clearly going to be less of them?
Right.
Why don't we accept the abundance that technology will give us? It's just that transition, that thought experiment that we're talking about right now is so difficult for current policymakers because, and actually current people to understand because they've never been in an environment where that that could happen.
So do you think then that, and I don't think this would happen, but, you know, just as a thought experiment, maybe the most humane and ideal way to transition would be to just wipe all debt, have like a debt jubilee, you know, on a wide scale. And then just, you know, basically, I don't know, in a way, like with whatever assets, if there are any that are left in the US government, I guess there's probably not many, you know, just kind of give Bitcoin to people.
Well, so, and no, because, and I get asked that question a lot, but so remember, let's just, and I'm not going to use me as, I'll pretend this is me. Yeah. I have tons of real estate holdings across the country and everything else. And I'm an individual. So, and because of monetary policy, and because of inflation, everything else, because of everything else, I was allowed to accumulate tons of wealth. And in the current environment, because of monetary policy, I'm able to create way more wealth because of protecting it from falling, right? And by stimulating the stimulative monetary policy, it's going to go up again, right? And now, so I have all of that real estate. Now somebody says, okay, debt jubilee, all debt is wiped out.
Yeah.
What happens to my real estate? So do I just get that gift forever?
Right.
And now just roll that up. If that's a country, do they get that gift forever? Do they get, and so I don't think that that's the way to solve it. Because it's, because essentially you've locked in the
wealth inequality.
Wealth inequality, but you've actually locked in gains, not by productive gains.
Right.
Right. You've got, it's, so there's a lot of people in my group, it's other CEOs, other everything else, and wealthy people that they call them the one percenters. There's a lot of people in that group that that actually think they got their wealth because of their ingenuity.
Right.
And they didn't. And there's a lot of people that are investigating this way deeper as well and saying, this doesn't make any sense. But there's some people in that totally believe in kind of the frameworks that they've always had, and they have no idea it's just been a gift from monetary easing.
Right. And that's, you know, generations like the millennial generations coming up behind them are, you know, I seem to understand that pretty well because they have not benefited from those policies.
Well, so that's when you, as you keep going down, that's why I said what ends up happening is revolution or war. You just get it. And maybe that starts with socialism, but socialism isn't the answer to solve this.
Right.
Yeah. So why Bernie Sanders gets really popular and from a new generation of people and essentially is the same thing. It's not your fault. It's those people's fault.
Right.
They stole it from you and everything else. We're going to redistribute it. But that's not solving it from a root cause problem either. So you have politicians on both sides of the aisles screaming at each other, both wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, like you said, maybe the way out of this might be through socialism, or at least we might get there because of the anger from that's resulting with the young people.
That path. Yeah, so that path, if you actually chose that path, I don't think you'd get there. What you're going to get to is the revolution war faster.
Okay.
Right. And that's what I'm getting at. That path, if you start doing that path, how do you think Hitler got elected?
Right. Yeah. Damn.
And what did he do? He chose the people who had money, and those were the enemy.
Right. Yeah. Right.
This pattern repeats in history all the time. Is a whole bunch of people lose faith, lose hope in a better future.
Yeah.
They rise up. It's easy to manipulate people.
Right. Yeah. So how do we solve this? I mean, obviously not, I think solve's the wrong word, but how do we improve this wealth inequality situation in the short term? I mean, if we transition into a Bitcoin world, you almost sort of stamp that inequality into the kind of the new money as well, because that's, you know, where we're
actually
at.
I don't think you do.
You don't think
actually,
so?
I think in Bitcoin, you don't stamp that because cool. there's a whole bunch of people that
it's too late.
It's too late.
Yeah.
I think you're, so no, I don't think you stamp that into Bitcoin.
Yeah. Great. That makes sense. So like as wealthy people who wait around too long, basically will be trading in, you know, bad money for much less of the good money. And so there's a big redistribution based on early adoption.
Huge redistribution.
Yeah. So then you've got money in the hands of Bitcoin early adopters, a lot of money. And, you know, the ideals of, you know, Bitcoiners, monetary ideals are obviously a lot different. And it'd be interesting to see how sort of those, I guess, libertarian or, you know, sound money, monetary system ideals will dovetail with an abundant future. Do you think it's a good match?
So I think you mentioned this with Keynes and everything else. Because we can't understand the complexity of an individual or somebody's idea, or when you say libertarians or Keynes and everything else, people want to put people in these little boxes and say, that's who they are. They always did this. And so if you look at actually all of the different economists, and some of them very, very thoughtful, right? But they don't get known for the wide range of thought. They got the narrow, very narrow, and it's like that. And because our brains can't accept that complexity and so we label people really easily. Right. And so even when you said libertarian or everything else, if you just said libertarian, I bet you there's a giant spectrum in libertarian. Right.
Yeah.
And all these spectrums and everything else. And so I think something like Bitcoin and if governments pegged to it over time and sound money came, I think we would have a different way of living where prices would fall everywhere, where we wouldn't have to be on a treadmill of work forever for rising prices everywhere. And capitalism would work perfectly. Yeah. People who wanted to work more would work more. You drive higher savings rate, and you wouldn't be on this endless treadmill for growth at the expense of for growth that is actually a mirage. Right, the entire growth model right now, if you accept $4 for every $1, and now it's way worse, and it's going to be way worse going forward. All of any real growth is just a total mirage.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, let's talk a bit about the future, some more about the future and technological abundance. So I know that you are on boards and you've been CEO and founded several tech companies. So you have your kind of fingers on the pulse of the, you know, the kind of the upper echelon of the tech scene, probably more so than most of us. So I'd love to hear from you what kinds of tech that you're seeing that you know, maybe the knowledge of is not, you know, well distributed among the people who aren't in that world.
And you know, from the book I wrote about some of these things in the book, but the pace of AI it's so staggering how fast that's moving, and not just what people think AI is today, deep learning algorithms and narrow purpose AI. And again, you know from the book, but even if you said AI is better at one domain than a human being, so forget general purpose AI, where AI is better, smarter than all of us. Just like a narrow domain, and say AI is better than us because it can see more errors, right? It can see it, and it can, it feeds back, and it gets better and better with deep learning. But if you just accept that, then, and you say, what do we do for our jobs, right? We go to school, we practice something narrowly over and over and over and over again, and we get better and better at it. And that race to get the best at something, and the highest and the best at something, gets paid way more than the second best, right? Is what drives our careers and our learning and the things we do, right? And AI is already starting to do that job in multiple industries way better than the best. Okay. And it's moving into countless industries. So if you
what
just
are, say, what are some examples?
Well, so radiology today. Yeah. Radiology today, you'd go to school to be a radiologist. AI can pick up way better than doctors today, radiologists today, what breast cancer, a whole bunch of different things. So now you have a technology that effectively at some point is free. Do you as a person, if you need to see a radiologist, are you going to go and pay the doctor and spend the time there, or use the free technology that's 10 times better, right? And maybe right now it's not 10 times better, but in a year it will be, in 2 years it'll be 100 times better. And so that path is across everything. It's across. And so that's something I'd say people don't realize how fast that's moving. And then I'm close to some of the research scientists that are the next generation of AI, probabilistic programming and different areas of AI that Frank Wood from the UBC, I'm helping him in one of his companies, but he's the foremost researcher in the world in this area of AI, which could be one of the missing links to move AI from deep learning to general purpose. Mm-hmm. And so there's a whole bunch of people working on this type of stuff as well. But what I would say, and then some of the companies I'm involved in, some of the technologies, there's lots of opportunity. There's tons of opportunity still. It changes like this that are moving this fast, break existing industries at a crazy speed, and provide new entrants to if you know where to go. Mm-hmm. Amazing opportunities. One of my companies that I co-founded projected $40 million in April, and that was up 40 times over last year, and ended up doing $86 million in April.
Wow!
And so there's tremendous opportunities if you know where to build, how to build, how do you build network effects, how do you take advantage of data into the system so it feeds back on itself. Tremendous. Mm-hmm. Across agriculture, across health, across a whole bunch of different domains that haven't been digitized yet. Mm-hmm. But will be. So there's tons of opportunity, but why I wrote the book is that opportunity, if I just roll up that opportunity of creating those companies into an overall system, it's way less jobs.
Yeah. Yeah. So at that point, you know, the people, if prices are falling and approaching zero, like there's a couple of other books that reminded me of yours, Abundance by Peter Diamandis, which was very interesting. And one that I read, right before I discovered Bitcoin, and I was kind of in the place where I think a lot, and Bitcoiners tell the story a lot, where sort of like kind of hopeless about the future. And you just, you know, don't think there's much opportunity to really grow. And you just kind of like, and like politics, you know, politics doesn't really work. And you just get the sense that things are just like stagnant and not fair and sort of degrading over time. And I read the book Abundance by Peter Diamandis, and you know, got a lot, or a little, at least a little bit more hopeful about the future. And then I found Bitcoin and I was like, okay, this really solves like the root problem. So if we can make this happen, then we can really rebuild society from the bottom up based on Bitcoin. And then the other book was Zero Marginal Cost Society, I think it's called, yep, by Jeremy Rifkin. So have you read those books, and I guess, yeah, have they influenced you?
I read both. One of the things, and I know Peter, Peter's a friend. And so one of the things that I think the entire abundance, by the way, his book is awesome. The Abundance is a really great book, but
super inspiring.
Yeah. But the one thing that a lot of the people in the tech sector missed and still miss is this. When they talk about that, about the abundance from tech without talking against the monetary system that's stopping that, they're only one side of the equation. And they don't realize that distribution to society is not going to happen. It's going to break it. And so that's the thing that actually got me kind of going down the rabbit hole a way deeper, because it doesn't make sense. I had a friend, I won't mention the friend or the company, but working on general purpose artificial intelligence, and came to me for an investment in the company, and their pitch was this: this is a $10 trillion opportunity. Right? Our business is going to be worth $10 trillion because of the displacement of all of these companies that it creates. And if you buy the hypothesis that it creates that displacement and it does this job for no cost, then you cannot buy it's a $10 trillion opportunity. Right? It's impossible.
Yeah.
But that's the logic fallacy that so many people, they're talking about existing systems applied to technology and thinking that and missing the fact that technology changes these massively.
Yeah.
And changes that, and by changing them, changes the size of those industries.
Mm-hmm. Right. So do you think then that the future, like, ultimate trajectory of this, like a deflationary society combined with, or deflationary monetary policy combined with a deflationary technology, then is like some sort of technological, you know, I guess utopia, for lack of a better word, that start like Star Trek, like, or something.
It's more like Star Trek instead of Star Wars.
Yeah.
It's and where people who want to work will work, but you'll have way more time. You actually could have a whole new renaissance of time. We would value time,
right? Yeah.
And if you just, why do you do the things you do? Right. If you kind of pull that back. So I spend 80 hours a week in work to do more and more and more, so I can save enough money so that one time I can retire and I can have more time with my family or travel.
Right. When your kids are all grown up and it's like, and it never happens.
How many people are trapped in that?
Yeah. So
many. And they think that I'm doing it for the one day I can finally enjoy my life.
Right, exactly.
Right. What if you could have that all the time? What if you could have it right now all the time? And actually, you know, I know there's a lot of people who would listen to this that can't because they've lived in a different world and everything else. But I would say that's going to be easier and easier and easier. And if you value your time, and really value your time, it's amazing how much time you actually have.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what we talk about as Bitcoiners all the time, is the idea of long-term time preference versus a short time preference, which, you know, this is the society we live in, is, you know, short time preference society. It's, you know, it's based on the money. That's where it comes from. That the money sort of pushes society that way, pushes individuals that way. And one of the things that, you know, I talk about a lot on this podcast is like the shift in the mindset when you understand kind of long-term thinking and deflationary money and the way money should be, is to start to value your time, right? The scarcest asset that we have is our time. And the second thing should be the money, right? So that, you know, it closely represents our time, which is what it's supposed to do. So when you think about that world, I mean, the opening to this podcast, is the tagline is "Welcome to the dawn of the Bitcoin Renaissance."
Right.
and which I love that you mentioned that. You know, if you look back to the Renaissance, and we can dive into a little bit of history here, but you look in back to the Renaissance, and it was, you know, an era that was based on a gold standard that was really enforced by you know, some very wealthy merchants. But I think that they understood the value of sound money and kind of enforced that that standard for the most part. But you had an era where humans were able to really pursue their crafts, their passions, and really, yeah, just really hone that talent and create just generational works of art and architecture and And that's where that came from. You know, it's not because
literature, everything. Yep.
Yeah. All of that. All of that. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess that's a period that we can look back on. I think the phrase Bitcoin Renaissance is completely apt there. So then do you think in the future, if we get to that society where, you know, technology is essentially free and our time is completely freed up, we're not, you know, wanting our needs or basic needs are met, and that we have, you know, this time freed up to basically pursue whatever we want to do. Does money even matter at that point? Like, do we even need money anymore?
And we're going way out there right now. And
yeah, this is hundreds of years.
It's going to be hard. It's going to be hard for people to get there. And if you think about along that way, so take Elon Musk's neural lace, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And where there's going to be people, and then more people, and then more people, we're going to mind and machine is going to melt.
Yeah.
Right. And so some of the things on the path. That's like before hundreds of years, there's going to be different things that are going to change the way we think what we need. And they're going to just break a whole bunch of things. But yeah, you mentioned it. If you're in an ecosystem, a monetary system, mm-hmm. It has way more effect on you than you know, right? More effect. It drives everything else. We say, we need the environment to be really great. Yet we'll drive if the cost of a gas car is cheaper, mm-hmm. we'll buy the gas car because cost in our life we need to be able to do this. Exploded in a currency in an economy. If coal is cheaper for China, they'll use coal because if they don't. They're at a disadvantage on their energy costs, and energy costs is the number one input for just about everything else. So it's hard mm-hmm. to stop things like this. So much of what we think we do is based on economics and trying to get more of the pie and everything else. And that energy cost example, you know, from my book, now solar is moving to lower cost energy. Right.
Yeah.
So that's deflationary in nature as well, because it's going to drive lower and lower cost energy. Mm-hmm. Eventually energy, this is going to be so bold to say this on it because people take it up, but eventually energy will be free or almost free. And so when you add some of these things that are happening, I can't see why wouldn't we want that? Wouldn't that be a good thing for society and all of us?
Yeah.
So if you add up some of these things, it means you have way more free time. You have way, the number of secondary effects that can happen. It's just true abundance, and we're stopping that from stopping that from happening, and people don't know it because they're so caught up in a loop of mm-hmm. the existing system that we live in.
Yeah. So a quick tangent on energy, since you mentioned it and brought it up. When you were first getting into Bitcoin, you know, almost always the first response or reaction to it is criticism, is the energy thing. Like, it takes all this energy to mine it. It's completely wasteful. I think it's probably because that narrative is out there in the mainstream media a lot. So did you balk at that idea, and how is your understanding about Bitcoin's energy use evolved?
So actually I some of that I accepted, right? And mm-hmm. if that energy was coming from coal, they're right. Right. Mm-hmm. And over time, it's not as big an energy drain as everything, even if you forecasted it forward. But ultimately that's a lot of energy. And if it was dirty energy, but that's not what it'll look like.
Yeah.
Right? It'll look totally different, and that energy cost will decline. The energy costs will decline, and it'll be clean energy in time.
Yeah.
In fact, the race for innovation there will create an incentive to drive it faster.
Yeah. And that's the argument that Bitcoiners have been trying to get out, is, and we see evidence of that, right? I mean, it's a race to, I mean, the only two inputs into Bitcoin mining are the CapEx and the energy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the CapEx is obviously coming down as well through deflationary, you know, digital technology. And then the energy inputs, the need for energy for Bitcoin mining, is going to drive down the cost. I mean, mining is just a search for the cheapest, you know, energy.
Right.
And so it's incentivizing that and more, of course, it's solar. It's excess energy from like solar, hydro dams, you know, because there's lots of excess energy that, you know, is generated during like rainy seasons that can't be used, right? And that's just kind of going to waste. But you throw a Bitcoin miner out there, you can turn it into money. We're capturing, you know, like methane that's being vented, you know, and turning it into energy. In fact, there's a company in Canada led by Steve Barber. You should check it out. He's on the forefront of capturing excess like oil and methane out in rural Canada and turning it into Bitcoin. He's got these really cool mining rigs that just go and drop it off in a field. Definitely passionate about getting that argument out there because it's not intuitive and it's easy. It's one of those arguments. It's like, you look at the numbers or you make a comparison, like it's using more energy than, you know, the country of Ireland. But then you look at the other, you know, another analogy is it's less energy than Christmas lights in America used every year. It's like, So I think I want to wrap up the end of your book. The last chapter is action items, which I love because it's very sort of a corporate phrase or term that we use in the business world. And like, let's take the action items out of this meeting. What can we, what should we, in your opinion, as individuals, do in the next 5, 10, 15 years to kind of move to a deflationary monetary policy?
So as individuals, get the message out. But get the message out in a positive light. So I've said this on a couple other podcasts. It boggles my mind that there's a whole bunch of Bitcoiners fighting with gold bugs and viciously, right? It boggles my mind. And because if you actually look at at a higher level, both believe in the same thing. They both believe in the exact same thing, sound money, right? And one could be right and one could be wrong. And maybe gold, maybe central governments go back to gold standard. I think it's implausible myself, but I don't disrespect somebody for having that opinion.
Sure.
Right. I just think there's an asymmetric bet because Bitcoin's at a $150 billion market cap and gold's at a $8 to $10 trillion market cap. And if Bitcoin wins, it'll inverse.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But the people that believe in gold, I know why they believe in gold and I respect them for it. Right. So the bigger, I think you can build bridges. And I think there's a whole bunch of people in your community and others that can build bridges. If you go one step above that in governments and everything else on the socialist side or the capitalist side and everything else, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
Like people are, what's happening is people are believing a narrative and they're getting further and further away from somebody else and they're trying to, and they're dividing it and everything else. And if you go up another level, you kind of go, wait a second. We're all caught in this little loop over here and we're fighting with each other over this stupid little thing when it doesn't matter. And that's why I tried to go really at a high level in the book and then try to drive in how we easily get stuck in our current framework.
Yeah.
Right. And the biases that we carry and everything else. Because at the highest level, if technological deflation is going to happen anyways, right. I'll debate anybody on that. Right. And it's going to accelerate from here.
Yeah.
Then there's few choices.
Yeah.
Right. Let's have that conversation. So how do you have that conversation? Unite people on that. Mm-hmm. Unite people on that. Have them tell you why that can't happen. And if that can happen, then the other things are a byproduct of it.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And I think it has to happen outside of the, you know, political system. Like I don't, you know, I see some Bitcoiners in the traditional, you know, this political system, which I think is good. You know, we need the conversation to happen there as well. But there's just this, you know, trajectory of division, like you're talking about in the political sphere, where it's just arguing over these little band-aids, you know, and using, you know, wedges between two people to just like separate them and be like, okay, you guys fight. We're going to go ahead and control the world while you guys are doing that.
So here's the one difference. I don't think they're trying to do it.
Sure. Yeah.
It's a product of a system. If you think of system based thinking, mm-hmm. and that's why I say you have to question the system, and it's hard to. Businesses fail all the time. Kodak invented the digital camera, and twice Steve Sasson, who had invented it, right. was rejected by executives, because it would kill their business, and yes, it would kill their business, and they invented it and didn't take any of it, right? Yeah. And ended up in bankruptcy. That's what's happening in a system today. There's a whole bunch of people that are stuck in a system, and are rejecting. With the kind change. Of the first principle that we're talking about. And so they're trying to, they don't see it. Most of them don't see it.
Right.
One of the top central bankers from, it actually was one of the reasons that for me really getting off my ass and writing the book, the top central banker in Canada said to me about technological deflation. And he goes, yes, but what would you have us do? And I went, that's not an answer. Right? That is not an answer. So, yes, what would you have us do is not an answer. So I thought, we need to talk about, okay, yes, how do we build a better future? That's the answer.
Yeah. All right, one more question. Sorry, I thought it was supposed to be the last one, but I've meant to ask this earlier and just reminded of it. What do you think about UBI?
I think that UBI, without dealing with the root cause problem, creates a whole bunch more problems.
Okay. Yeah.
So again, assets are unnaturally lifted because we're mm-hmm. unnaturally lifting them. And now we're trying to give a whole bunch of gift of UBI that we can't pay for to a whole bunch of people to pay for the prices that we are artificially sure. manipulated. So without dealing in a system, you're just going to create more and more division.
Yeah. Do you think it's marginally better than giving that money to banks and corporations?
So I think there has to be something like it as a social safety net as we transition.
Okay.
But again, I want to be really careful with doing it without like blindly, because right now what's happening is it's going to cement divide into the society.
Yeah.
And if a whole bunch of people that are going, taxes are going up is saying, well, why am I paying for those people? And you're going to divide people more, yeah. right? And it, without dealing with the root cause of the problem in the first place. So it's not that I'm necessarily against it in some sort of principle, because I think you need a transition mechanism.
Gotcha. Yeah.
But a transition mechanism without understanding the first principle of the problem you're trying to solve. Is pouring more gas on a fire.
Yeah. It only makes sense in the context of, you know, hey, we're in a transition to a new money. And so we're going to do this as a policy as part of the transition. Otherwise, yeah, that makes sense. Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this all plays out. I think we as Bitcoiners who have sort of stumbled upon this knowledge, I guess, that was sort of lost to a lot of people around the world, have that responsibility, like you said, to really carry it forward. And I've been saying this on the podcast too, especially the last few months, that really now is our time as Bitcoiners, that we really need to be out there and talking about this and be responsible about the way we present things. And
that's the piece, right?
Yeah.
So that's the piece in the community. There is too many, because I get it. I'm going to say it. When I was early in an entrepreneur life, effectively they're going up against a system, right? Mm-hmm. And when you're doing that and you have one or two people, it's mm-hmm. you against the world, and everybody calls you a fool.
Right.
That's what happened. Right? And when it starts to win, what you want to do is say, "Told you jerk!" Right? right? That's what you want to do, because I'm right, you're wrong. Right.
Yep.
And you your ego gets away on you and everything else. If I apply that, and by the way, I did it, right. And in my own company, and learned a terrible lesson by doing it, realized like, so that humility, right now mm-hmm. in Bitcoin. I think a lot of people in Bitcoin are largely right, and from but that humility to build bridges and go to a higher level and focus on the reason will build bridges way faster and drive that. So yeah. that's the piece, and I don't see that everywhere in the Bitcoin community.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And you're never going to see it, you know, completely in any community. There's always going to be, you know, there's just a range of people, and Bitcoin is, you know, it is already a pretty big tent in terms of the types of people it's brought in, lots of, you know, across the political spectrum. You know, demographically, maybe not so much, at least, but I'm kind of trapped in this kind of Western, you know, viewpoint, and I'm trying to branch out, from that more and talk to Bitcoiners in South America and Africa and Asia a bit more. So I hope that will help on my perspective and my listeners too. But yeah, I think we have that responsibility. We need to think about that very seriously as Bitcoiners. And one of the big kind of well-known Bitcoiners, he has a podcast along with Marty. He does like a weekly recap on Bitcoin news with Marty, and you've been on his podcast, Matt O'Dell. And his sort of meme that he's put out there is "Stay humble, stack sats."
Love that. I love that.
So I think that's the message. We'll end it right there. Thanks so much, Jeff. Go get the book. It's a fantastic price of tomorrow. And enjoy it. And let's talk about these ideas and spread them around. Thanks for the time, man. Appreciate it.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Thanks to Jeff for joining me. It was an absolute honor, a pleasure to speak with Jeff today. You can find Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Booth, at JeffBooth. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Bitcoin Twitter. Jeff's website, where you'll also find the book, is jeffreybooth.com. The podcast website is citizenbitcoin.world. I'd love for you to share this out with family and friends. You know, the bull is incoming. We can all feel it, right? So get them on board with some great Bitcoin content. Sign them up at swanbitcoin.com, Swan Signal podcast, the Citizen Bitcoin podcast. Get them hooked up. All right. Thanks again, of course, to Swan for sponsoring the episode, making this possible to bring to you all. Let's Talk Bitcoin Network for including the podcast in the feed. Thanks to BTC Media, Christian Carolus, shout out there. You can also check out my merch store. Shout out Nick Ward, great Bitcoiner. Layer1BTC.com. Click partners and then Citizen Bitcoin. Lots of cool stuff there to check out, including some OPSEC-friendly stuff. Check out the podcast that I've created for Swan, Swan Signal Podcast. Again, two awesome guests. So make sure you get this feed into your podcast app, swansignalpodcast.com. Adam Back and Preston Pish will be on the most recent podcast when you add that to your podcast app. So if you have any questions for me, please feel free to reach out. I've been hearing from you guys more and more, and I really love chatting with you all. My DMs are open on Twitter. I'm at Citizen Bitcoin on Telegram. And my email address is citizenbitcoin@pm.me. All right, that's it for this week. Take care out there, Bitcoiners, wherever you happen to be in the world.